Devasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Reading this morning from text 34 of chapter 11, another very nice verse in a series of very nice verses. This is a fighting verse. Fighting verse. The Lord was pacified after killing those kings who were burdensome to the earth. They were puffed up with their military strength, their horses, elephants, chariots, infantry, etc. He himself was not a party to the fight, or in the fight. He simply created hostility between the powerful administrators, and they fought amongst themselves. He was like the wind. Which causes friction between bamboos and so sparks a fire. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. As stated above, the living beings are not factual enjoyers of things which are manifested as God's creation. The Lord is the genuine proprietor and enjoyer of everything manifested in His creation. Unfortunately, influenced by the deluding energy, the living beings become, in italics, a false enjoyer under the dictation of the modes of nature. Shortly before coming here, towards the end of September, I had scheduled a visit to Detroit, ISKCON, the temple in Detroit, and I didn't know it ahead of time, but there was a man from Sri Lanka, Dr. Ari something, who has formed his own international organization for bringing peace to the world. And he's got a lot of followers. And somehow I was there the same weekend that he was doing a big, whatever he called it, peace conference. He called it One Peace. And part of that, it was like a series of 10 days leading up to a big conference hall, or a convention hall, excuse me, big assembly of people to get together and see if they can bring peace into the world. Well, I was supposed to be a co-speaker. When they found out I was going to be in town, suddenly I was a co-speaker with this Dr. Ari something-something at the Hare Krishna Temple in Detroit. It's the Fisher Mansion. Fisher Mansion. He was part of he was a very, very wealthy man during the beginning of the auto industry in Detroit. What he was famous for was designing chassis for Ford Motor Company, General Motors, and all of them, Chrysler, and all of them. It was Body by Fisher. So he made a mansion and very humbly named it after himself, the Fisher Mansion. And it's a beautiful place. He brought artisans from Italy to do the finest inlaid mosaic in this room, that room, you know, beautiful thing. Then after he followed the course that everybody else does that is born in this world, he died. It was this big mansion that was hard to maintain. And so when it was in not a really safe neighborhood, like it was a bad neighborhood, but he built it there because it was right by the Detroit River, and he had these three boat docks inside the building. You know, you could sort of zoom, go out on the Detroit River and have fun and have parties in his Fisher Mansion and entertain all of his aristocratic friends and show off his beautiful artistic mansion and so on. Anyway, so it was up for sale, and it was for peanuts because it was, nobody had any use for it. So that was found out that it was up for sale, and two devotees, one was the grandson of Henry Ford and the granddaughter of Walter Reuther, which doesn't mean anything to you, but Henry Ford was this very, very powerful person that built cars. And the people who built the cars were the auto workers. And there was always competition between the auto workers and the people that owned the auto company, Henry Ford. But the granddaughter of Walter Reuther was a Prabhupada disciple. She, together with Ambarish, bought the Fisher Mansion. Let it go. I don't know if there's anything comparable here in India, but like two very aristocratic families with opposite interests, because they became devotees, it became very peaceful. And they worked together to achieve the same end, to purchase the Fisher Mansion. It fits in with our message. Opposites can be completely cooperative under the banner of and the shelter of Krishna's lotus feet. Just like Sachinandan Swami was describing one time that, you know, I have a confession to make. My father was a Nazi. I grew up in Germany. And my father was one of those people that killed so many Jews in the name of, you know, following the party line. And Radhanath Maharaj then spoke and said, and my father lost all of his relatives in those concentration camps that his father was in charge of, who were the best of friends. There's no enmity. Because look what your father did. But under the banner, under the shelter of Krishna's lotus feet, complete harmony. And so many other examples one might give. So at this Fisher Mansion, the gentleman, Dr. It's a long name. I say something, something. It's a longer name than Ari, but the first two syllables are Ari. The rest are like five more syllables. So I just refer to him as Dr. Ari, and everybody kind of was doing the same thing. So his program, well, to put a label, he's a Gandhian Buddhist. Gandhian because he very much valued cottage industries, indigenous labor, people getting together, helping one another in communities. And, you know, somebody builds a house and somebody grows the crops and somebody else makes the tools, and you all work together and you have a cooperative community. on kind of communistic principles, sharing principles. Rather than money, it's trade. I'll give you so much grain and you build my house. And then somebody needs a house built, so 10 people go and help them build their house. They have a problem. Anyway, community effort. Gandhian. And Buddhist, no sense of God, no sense of the soul, but trying to bring peace. All huddled around, so what's this? What's that central point that they huddled around? He explained it. It's service. Something that everybody does. He got one thing right. Something that everybody does is they serve. So that he explained the beginning of their weekly gatherings. They say a prayer to assist one another through their collective service, and then they take up a project. And the project is build a school, or build a hospital, or build some homes, or build a road, or, you know, help somebody grow the crops. And then it's collective crops, so everybody has something. In a country, Sri Lanka is very much torn by strife. This group, that group, and they're violent. I mean, you know more about it than I do. Violent. So in the midst of that violence, the poor people have nothing, and the rich people are fighting over who's going to have control over the poor people who have nothing. And, you know, murders and gangs and groups and self-interest, abundant self-interest, and meanwhile people are still not having things. And so his effort was to let people generate from the land the things that they require, and a sense of community, a sense of protection, a sense of well-being, and a sense of spirituality by common service. And that's his platform of peace. So our comment as we read will hold up Dr. Airy as Prabhupada's example of a philanthropist, because he used that very word, philanthropy, but it's a type of fruitive work. It's a type of fruitive work that was appreciated by the very wealthy American people that were attending this thing. In fact, he had come, I mean, I could read between the lines very quickly. He had come not to promote peace. He had come to raise funds for his program in Sri Lanka from the wealthy Americans that don't want to be accountable to God or surrender to God, but they want peace. So here's a man that can make it happen. He's going to roll up his sleeves and take their money and make it happen. Build houses and build schools and build hospitals and make it happen. No God. No surrender. No soul. No commitment. So he spoke first, I spoke second. And when I spoke, I said, on the topic of peace, my thoughts immediately went to my spiritual master, who wrote a little publication called Peace Formula, because when I had become a devotee, it was during the Vietnamese War. And these people were my age, so they were going, yeah, we know about the Vietnamese War. And there was a lot of concern about the Vietnamese War, so to the audience that Prabhupada was addressing, and so he wrote a little piece called, a little pamphlet called The Peace Formula. And I said, I personally distributed hundreds of thousands of those Peace Formula brochures or, you know, little booklets And one of the essential messages is exactly the same message that Prabhupada is presenting here. That is, I was thinking of bringing it so I could recite it like word for word, because Prabhupada's language is so powerful. But his message was that when the lack of peace is due to human beings who, he used the word encroach, they like sneak up and steal. That's a nice way of saying steal. They encroach upon the property that does not belong to them, because in fact the property, all the entire creation, comes from one source, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and therefore, since he is the source of it, he is the proprietor of it. Failing to recognize this one fact, Prabhupada said, is if not largely, or if not entirely, at least largely, the cause for the lack of peace in this world. So to reverse the lack of peace requires acknowledging who the proprietor is. Because proprietorship means then this thing is meant for the enjoyment of its proprietor. So there's some bicycles outside, and the bicycle is meant for the person who owns it to get from point A to B. And if I don't recognize who is the proprietor, I just grab one and just go for a ride. Or motorcycle, I figure out how to start a motorcycle without the key, and zoom, zoom, off I go, because I'm not recognizing the proprietor. Well, then you go, just keep going. You know, something, you stumble along something in life and you try to make it yours without recognizing who is the real proprietor. Ishopanishad is filled with this notion. The whole book, the whole foundation of Ishopanishad is about proprietorship. And Prabhupada explains isms or doctrines. Capitalism, communism, totalitarianism, this ism and that ism, ideologies. Look carefully and you'll see what it's all resting upon: proprietorship. It belongs to the state. It belongs to the capitalist. It belongs to the laborer. It belongs to nobody. It belongs to the czar. And it belongs to the military. It's about proprietorship. And they're all false. They're all, putting it nicely, encroaching upon the property of someone else. Putting it more bluntly, they're thieves. They're bandits. They're gundas, in your local vernacular over here. In the name of some nice ism. And the same as Dr. Ari. But it's a niceism. People think it's a niceism. It doesn't belong to anybody. You just help each other to get those things that you need so you can enjoy yourself. You have food to eat, and your roof over your head, and you have the essentials. And this nice man is helping to provide people that don't have essentials to have their essentials and build camaraderie and build a whole worldwide organization. He was claiming at least that he has something like over some number of thousands of villages organized on this principle under the banner of his, whatever it is, organization. And the flag says peace. Well, let's read on and see what Prabhupada says about that idea. Unfortunately, influenced by the deluding energy, the living entity becomes a false enjoyer. In italics, a false enjoyer. under the dictation of the modes of nature. Puffed up by such a false sense of becoming God, now that's putting it really bluntly, because being the enjoyer is the position of God. So we don't usually say, oh, we're trying to become God. We're just saying, you know, we're enjoying life. What's wrong? We're just having the necessities of life, and we're enjoying those necessities of life. The problem is not having the necessities of life. The problem is missing the real point of who is the enjoyer, even while you're accepting the necessities of life. So the peace formula in Bhagavad Gita is 529. What's Bhagavad Gita 529? Where's our Shloka Raj? Where's Krishna Das? Oh. 529, Bhagavad Gita. The last verse of chapter 5. Bhoktaram. Anyone else amongst our learned, scholarly students here? Very good. Bhoktaram Jagatapasam? Learn for tomorrow, okay? Boys and girls, learn this verse for tomorrow. 529 Bhagavad Gita. In that verse is what Prabhupada has called the peace formula. There's three things. Bhoktaram Jagatapasam. Tapa is austerity. And the bhokta of all tapa, bhoktaram yagyatapasam, so the with sacrifice there's some austerity, yes. So the enjoyer of all sacrifices, we're all making sacrifices, and we think we're making sacrifices, the adults are thinking we're making sacrifices for our family. The children are thinking, oh, I have to go to school. I'm making a sacrifice. I'd rather play. But I'm doing it for a long-term good, so I can become one who's taking care of a family in a nice way later on. So we're all sacrificing. I'm sacrificing to come on the other side of the planet to come and be with you. So we're all making some, there are some austerities and sacrifices we're making. Who is the enjoyer of that? Krishna. That's the peace formula. Why are we making that sacrifice for Krishna? Sarvaloka Maheshwaram. Ishwara. Ishwara means? Huh? Controller, very good. And Maha Ishwara or Maheshwara is the supreme controller. So, Sarvaloka Maheshwaram, he's the supreme proprietor, controller of everything. But what if he's mean? He's a controller, he owns everything, and we're making all these sacrifices for him. Well, don't worry. Suhridam sarvabhutanam, he's the well-wishing friend of everyone. Gyatvamam shantim. Richati, shanti. One becomes established in the position of peace by recognizing Krishna's position in these three categories. Bhoktaram Yogitapasam, Sarvaloka Maheshwaram, Suhridam Sarvabhutanam. Krishna is our dearmost friend. He owns everything, and everything that we do, we offer unto him as a sacrifice, Yajna Vai Vishnu. Then that's the platform of peace. And otherwise, well, who does everything belong to? Then you have your isms. doesn't belong to anybody. It's up for grabs. It belongs to the man who created the thing because he's the worker. It belongs to the man who capitalized the thing because he's the capitalist. It belongs to the state because we own everything. Well, how do we know we own? Because we said so. Lenin said so. And Stalin enforced it. Etc. All of this falls into the category of dharmasya-glani. Because the principle of how things should be addressed with Krishna as the proprietor and how we should act in relation to the things that are Krishna's property, how they should be used, that's dharma. And how we should relate to one another, that's dharma. Codes of conduct within the world that Krishna has created. He gave a user's manual. This is how you use this human form of life. And this is how you act with regard to nature and one another. Not following that, it's dharma shaglani, or discrepancy of dharma. But here Prabhupada translates that as misuse of the energy of the human being. That is to say, dharma is meant for man, not for dog. We don't invite the dogs in the neighborhood, please come and attend our assembly. We're discussing Srimad Bhagavatam this morning.
Ruff, ruff.
We don't invite the dogs. They couldn't understand even if we invited them. But it's for human beings. Human form of life is especially meant for coming to this position of not being situated as animals where might rules, but what's right or what's the plan of the Lord rules. We are ruled by the plan of the Lord. That's the human form of life. Well, the misuse of this human energy is dharma shaglani. So the verse is saying Krishna doesn't like that. So he came. When such misuse of human energy is prominent, the saner living beings, those are those that follow the principles of dharma, they're the sane ones. They become disturbed, perplexed. Perturbed by the awkward situation created by the vicious administrators, who are simply burdens on the earth, and the Lord appeared by his internal potency just to save the saner section of humanity. So Krishna comes to set it straight. This is dharma. And other than dharma, it's adharma. And there's varieties of adharma. And the varieties of adharma today are being taken as dharma. How abominable. Shameful. And I was almost going to say it to Dr. Shame on you, Dr. Airy. I didn't do it. But those are persons, although it's an ism, it's an ideology, so he's propagating like a learned man, but he's now administrating, so he's like a king with his little kingdom, with his little, you know, territory. It's not his land and his people, but it's a fact, his land and his people within the country of Sri Lanka and wherever else he's now going to expand his program and set up. The unwanted administrators, puffed up by false power. Now, the greater discrepancy, increasing the abuse, is to maintain my ism, I establish an army with weapons and the weapons of the time and the conveyances of the time, or the elephants and chariots and horses and foot soldiers and bowmen and so on. Thus they become engaged in fighting amongst themselves over ideological conflicts. What are those ideological conflicts about? Proprietorship. It can go under different labels, you know, democracy and some other ism. Or can go in the name of some religion. You know, you're fanatical religionists. We have to stop you because you're fanatical religionists. And so what are we? We're fanatical religionists. Our religion, our fanatical religion is better than your fanatical religion, so we should stop you. And feeling perfectly righteous. Perfectly righteous. Spending billions of dollars and gallons of blood and innocent people and non-innocent people, left and right, being killed. Perfectly justified. It's the price of war to bring protection. Not about protection. It's about proprietorship. The history of the world reflects this factual will of the Lord. So it's very explicit in the case of Krishna appearing. And he didn't take part in the battle, but he engaged others in the battle. He deliberately, you know, like one of the incidents when the palace of the Pandavas was created. There's the, what was it called? Swadharma Assembly Hall that was created by Maya Dhanava. And when Duryodhan went to visit, what he thought was water was land, and we thought was land was water, and he fell in the water. The queens of Dwaraka, and I believe they were with him, and the ladies of Hastinapur, they were laughing. Yudhisthira was telling them to not laugh. Krishna told them, laugh. Why? Duryodhan was getting furious. And that was the turning point where Duryodhan said, that's it. I tried to befriend the Pandavas and now they're laughing at me. I'm going to finish them off once and for all. Yes? Krishna was fanning that fire. Oh, look at that. Nice, very nice. Yes, laugh. Laugh at Duryodhan. In so many ways, explicitly and deliberately, inciting conflagration. Because he wanted the demoniac kings off the planet. And so, the arrangement was, of course, virtuous kings like the Pandavas would be party to that activity, but the demoniac kings would kill off the demoniac kings. Since that time, Krishna's been doing the same program. Look at any paper. This group and that group fighting against each other. It's not like, oh, Krishna's celebrating, this is great, they're killing each other. But the demoniac propensity is such that it's a burden on the earth. And so far better than just having them killed is having their demoniac spirit changed. But that's a big challenge. Because to have that spirit changed, they have to accept Krishna is the proprietor. And they don't want to recognize that. Because that makes them the servant. They don't want to be the servant. They want to be the proprietor. This means that no one can establish peace and prosperity in the world by fruitive activities. And that includes it's not just going to work and earning lots of money, and that's what fruitive activity is. Even, you know, the karma kanda section of the Vedas or the Buddhist, Gandhian Buddhist program. That's fruitive activity. It's not going to bring peace into the world. Why? Because the failure to recognize who does all this belong to. the model of helping one another, that's something that's also what Vaishnavas would do. But it's for Krishna to restore that property in its rightful position as enjoyed by Krishna. We don't recognize Krishna as the enjoyer. It's a hopeless situation. There will never be peace. At the time I didn't know who was the head of the Sikh religion for a long time. Yogi Bhajan. Yes? Yogi Bhajan? Anybody here know? At least in America. The Sikh religion in America had as their leader Yogi Bhajan. And he liked what Prabhupada was doing. I heard a recording. Yogi Bhajan was inviting people. They said, Swamiji, let us have a big conference. Big hall. Madison Square Garden. And have everybody come together. Let's get together and be peaceful together. And Prabhupada cut him off and said, they will never. Just like that. They will never. The sentiment is nice, but what's required, they will never. Accepting the position of Krishna as proprietor, they will never. They want peace, but they're busy violating the laws of Dharma. They're busy misusing this human form of life. They're busy causing pain and suffering to other living beings at their expense, and they want peace? The only way is to surrender unto the Supreme Lord and thus become free from the illusion of the deluding energy. So this is, I want to emphasize this point. And thus become free from the influence of the deluding energy, the illusion of the deluding energy. That's the platform of peace. Why is it? So we'll turn it around the other way. Why is it that the devotee is peaceful? Does it mean, like the example in Bhagavad Gita, the lotus flower that's untouched by water? Does it mean the lotus flower, there's never any storms, there's never any ripples in the surface of the water because of the waves? No, the wind will come also in the pond, in the lake. The disturbance will be there, but the lotus remains untouched by that. The devotee remains peaceful despite the disturbances of duality, because they're fixed beyond duality. They're fixed in the absolute, in Krishna. So that's what peace is. Peace means to become free from the deluding potency of the Lord. So I was asked during this question-answer session of the One Peace event. It was a devotee. And he was serious. He said, do you think that there will be peace in our time? And I said, depends on how you mean that. If you mean it like Neville Chamberlain meant, you signed a peace contract with Adolf Hitler. You invaded Poland and you shouldn't do that again. Okay, I won't do it again. Peace in our time. That's not peace. It's not going to happen. This is the age of Kali. It is the age where there is quarrel and strife and enmity between any two beings, including in the family. Not just, people out there. It's the age of quarrel and strife. Even Maharaj Parikshit, when Prabhupada addresses this, why didn't he just, he knew this was the personality of Kali, why didn't he just kill him? It would have saved people a lot of problems. But he didn't, because it was the plan of the Lord. This is the age of Kali. So our plan is not to make it not the age of Kali, it's the age of Kali. But our plan is, so there will be peace for persons who take shelter of Krishna. And the option is there. Watch things deteriorate or take shelter of Krishna. On sound spiritual basis, on the authority of Scripture and practical experience, when we live our lives according to the principles of Bhagavad Gita, we find peace. Gyatva mam shantim richati. Here we are in the midst of one urban area that's growing and becoming dirtier and crazier and wilder, and but we're growing in our peaceful, happy life. And we're doing some small token effort to bring the holy name and bring transcendental literature and bring Krishna Prasadam and into the lives of people who will accept. Because without this knowledge and without this way of life, Prabhupada writes, they have no information of the living energy. And being ignorant of that supreme spiritual science, they are absorbed in material science, which ends with the material body. Just share this with you. In the second weekend of September, we had a mantra yoga retreat. It was kind of an experiment. Mantra yoga retreat. It was advertised on the university campus, Penn State University, which is like an hour's drive away from our farm in Mid-Pennsylvania, Gitanagari Farm. Krishna's arrangement, they got a permission to have a banner right across the main arch where everybody walks through, or many of the students walk through to get onto the campus. Big arch, a big banner, mantra yoga retreat in the rural community in Mid-Pennsylvania. Cool, let's go. So a number of students came, and somehow they didn't read the mantra part, they just read yoga retreat. So they brought their yoga clothes and their yoga mat. It's one of those paraphernalia, you roll it up as a little rubber thing, you roll it out, you got your yoga mat, you're ready to go. Do your yoga. So when it was orientation on Friday evening, because it was a 3-day event, Friday evening, Saturday, Sunday, we started doing mantra yoga. You know, like, nice, Om Namo, but with harmonium, and explained what mantra is and mantra yoga, and the students were looking at each other like, what's going on? One of them turned to the other one, I found out later, and said, is this about God? I mean, they didn't come for God. They came for yoga. They were really uncomfortable. The vibration was, let's get out of here. Like tonight, if not tomorrow morning. So we just shifted gears. I sensed they were very uncomfortable and said, what would you all like? We could do this, we could do that, we could do... We want yoga. Okay, yoga, okay. So one devotee was a yoga instructor. We just completely changed the whole program. You know, before breakfast it was yoga. And then it was breakfast, and it was after breakfast yoga. And then it was after breakfast, or after breakfast, whatever it is, yoga. It was more yoga, different types, you know, sitting still kind of yoga, and then vinyasa, you know, flowing yoga, where you're doing, moving, and this yoga, that yoga. They got yoga'd up, they were real happy. I just fast forward. We took them through stages, and at the end, the detail's nice, but at the end of the evening on Saturday, it was mantra yoga. We did the same thing we did Friday night, and they had never been with devotees before. They didn't know anything about the whole program. But we took the same mantras, and they were, because they had gradually, step by step, been taken into, from yoga to pranayama, pranayama into the power of sound and PowerPoint on the power of sound and the ocean of Om. Very non-threatening. They liked it, you know. Breathe in three times and the third time, Om. Om. And the whole room filled with, it was a temple room. Radha Damodara's temple room. The door was closed. Filled with the ocean of Om. It was very nice. They felt very peaceful. Then Prashadam again. Then the evening kirtan. But it was mantra yoga. Kirtan yoga. Kirtan yoga. And we had a very, very wonderful singer, Badahari, who's just so nice. Just so nice. I mean, besides his singing voice, he's so humble. He's like the personification of humility and purity. And anybody who meets him immediately understands that. Here's a person who is pure and absolutely humble. And he sang so nicely. And as he was singing, then he went from one melody and one set of mantra to then another, shining on the board with projection. And it was very slow and meditative. Then the tempo started to pick up. And they looked at each other and stood up and started dancing. They had never seen devotees dance before. They were just like kids. They just started dancing. And then the whole room was up round and around, just like devotees do, and, you know, kirtan hall, dancing and dancing. And then he looked at us and shrugged his shoulders and started chanting Hare Krishna, and it was fine too, just chanting Hare Krishna, chanting and chanting and chanting. And at the end, they all were saying, they were saying it in unison, more, 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 more. Just like devotees do when they don't want the kirtan to end. So I said, okay, sit down. And it was very, very peaceful melody, very calming melody again. Nice melody. And at the end, a round of applause for 3 minutes. They were very happy. And then the feedback afterwards. I just got a letter from one that had attended that. And they said that they're now attending the program on a regular basis. They have weekly programs on campus, but it was nothing like that immersion and that weekend retreat where it was just spiritual experience. Although, you know, our sense of what is a spiritual experience and what they got was, you know, much less. But according to what they could handle, it was a very spiritual experience. And their sharing afterwards was similarly like, phew. They were moved. They were saying things like, I found a sacred space that I didn't even know existed and it's within me. And the power of mantra, I had never heard of this thing before, and now I know what I want to do the rest of the semester. Every day I want to do my yoga and chant my mantra. You know, they were like children. They really hadn't experienced anything like this. So it was all, the language was all new and the experience was all new, but they felt very safe. They said, I felt very safe in this sacred space. It was really wonderful. But persons don't even have a clue about the soul. These are even people that are thinking themselves to be spiritual. They don't have a clue. C-L-U-E, not a clue about the soul. But they want to be peaceful. And proprietorship, well, everybody knows it's up for grabs. You go into college and get a degree and you earn some money and you have property. That's what proprietorship's all about. The vital force of the soul within this human form of life is spoiled because of this misdirected lifestyle. And the persons that pass as leaders and philosophers and philanthropists are continuing to rob, like bandits, like thieves, this valuable, precious thing of the human form of life in the name of this-ism and that-ism. As Prabhupada would say, this is going on. It's so unfortunate. Since the human form of life is especially meant for reestablishing the lost relation with the Lord, they miss this opportunity by being engaged in material activities. They're robbed of their knowledge, because even after prolonged speculation, they cannot reach the stage of knowing the personality of Godhead, the summum bonum of everything. So how does that happen if it's not by pious works and speculative knowledge? It's by the mercy of devotees. My dear devotees, be merciful. Go out of your way. Inconvenience yourself from time to time to provide this opportunity for others to receive this knowledge. Because otherwise, they're just robbed of this very fundamental, vital principle of life. The whole society is rushing towards nowhere. Self-destruction is very sad, very dangerous. So, Krishna came. He came to remove that demoniac influence from the face of the earth without doing anything other than being like the wind. Of course, he reestablished the principles of religion. And our business, at least for the most part, the Hare Krishna devotees, is not to become military chiefs and generals and annihilate the miscreant population. Our process by Lord Chaitanya's method is to become pure and to offer that way of life of purity to others. And there are others that they're very gentle souls, and they haven't been introduced to Krishna consciousness, so they're being beaten up by this very cruel way of life. They probably feel like, you know, many of them feel that one of the students said, they're sharing afterwards, was, I have always felt that I'm a misfit. I mean, right in front of this group, you know, all undergraduate American kids, saying, I've always felt like a misfit because my values of life, I just don't find it anywhere. I've kind of reconciled myself, well, I guess I'm a misfit. But, you know, I feel validated now because I found this, not only I have these values, but there's this whole body of wisdom that expresses all of these values. And not only that, there's a path to follow to get there. And not only that, it's very easy and very, she didn't use the word sublime, but, you know, sublime. Joyful. I feel validated. And I want to keep doing this. Wow. Wow. And so now she's bringing her other friends to, you know, let's go have this experience of this sacred space. They were using the language. Let's go there and experience that. There's so many. If we can't change the world, at least we can rescue those sincere souls and give them shelter, even if it's one by one. So important. Become pure and offer the opportunity to others in a careful way to come into that sacred space and feel protection, feel validated, feel safe. That's what Krishna is affording in this, in the form of this Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Sankirtan movement. So our principal scripture, the authority that we follow, is Srimad Bhagavatam, and of course Bhagavad Gita. And our medicine is the chanting of the holy name. And of course our diet, everybody knows what our diet is. As soon as I finish speaking, we'll break the fast and have some prasadam. But it's a very simple, very sublime process. So valuable. The best humanitarian work. We can't have that without acknowledging by our way of life that Krishna is the proprietor of everything. Krishna is the proprietor of everything. Therefore, he is to enjoy everything, everything that we do. Everything. Okay. Any discussion? Well, you put a little twist in it that I didn't, but go right ahead. May I edit what you just said? Or that what you said, that I didn't say? Because when one recognizes Krishna's position as the enjoyer, that's not the mentality of a non-devotee. That's the mentality of a devotee. Bhoktaram jagatapasam. So, when one performs yajna, everyone's doing sacrifice, but when the enjoyer of the sacrifice is acknowledged as Krishna, that's a devotee. Ah. Now, does that address your question, or do you want to keep going? Everyone is doing action. They're also sacrificing. Oh. It's like if a mother and father have many children. And some of the children misbehave. Now how do they feel towards those children? I reject you. You're misbehaving. You can leave. They may be displeased by the behavior. So Krishna may be displeased by the behavior of persons that are inimical to him. He's not the enjoyer of their displeasing behavior. But that displeasing behavior can be ultimately rooted out if they simply acknowledge Krishna as the enjoyer. Krishna's unhappy by their unhappiness. He's neutral. Yes? But he's displeased because they're suffering too much. And when they're, especially when they're causing suffering to the saner section of society or those who are following Dharma, Krishna will come and stop them. Whatever it takes. And Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu comes to check that demoniac spirit and transform it into devotional spirit. So, a short answer is no. Krishna is not pleased by behavior that is adharmic. In fact, he comes to correct it. Yada yada hi dharma shaglanir bhavati bharata. Tadatmanam srijamyaham. At that time I come. But like the loving parent, he doesn't think, oh, you're bad. Behavior is bad. So let's correct the behavior. Yes.
Maharaj, the topic of peace, it seems like the devotees who are actually truly devoted, their life is not very peaceful. They have faced so many anxieties. It seems like that at least externally.
Well, and that's in the intermediate stage. In the advanced stage, the taking of trouble is another form of service, and service is the position of joy. No service, that's the position of suffering. Does your nice young boy over there, does he sometimes misbehave? Sometimes? Do you give him trouble sometimes? So how do you feel? It's my duty as a father to help my son understand what good behavior is. You've accepted that burden of love. And ultimately it's to deliver the soul to Krishna. Despite the misbehavior and something. It's a service. And it's a burden of love. If taken up in the right way. And if it's taken up in such a way that you become angry, why are you misbehaving? Is that going to bring about good behavior? It's going to bring resentment. More of the bad behavior. Yes? Real loud. Project your voice.
What does it mean when you said absolutely humble?
What does it mean to be absolutely humble? How to become? You have two questions. Well, there's no question of humility without being absolutely humble, because the other kind is not humble. You follow? If I cower and lower my head and tremble and do all those things, that doesn't mean humble. If inside I'm thinking, they don't understand how pure I am, how humble I am. They're not treating me with proper respect or something. And at a certain point, the threshold is crossed and humility stops and something else comes out. So real qualities are founded in spiritual reality. That's my point. Like, bhakti is pure bhakti. Humility is absolute humility. Truth is absolute truth. And so on. That's half your question. How do we get to that position of absolutely humble? By having only a spiritual conception. Or I was meditating on this morning with relation to the japa discussions we've been having. There's only one shelter. And that's Krishna. So, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's instruction, Trinadapi Sunichena. If you have any other shelter, then that humility isn't going to be manifest. The mind will wander and somebody, you go on chanting, but you're not in that position of humility. The position of humility is when there's only one shelter. So like this expression, because I was also chanting in that mood this morning. Krishna, please accept me. There's only one shelter. And the tendency for the mind to go to other places was checked by that mood of humility. It was protection. From the onslaught of illusion and the deluding potency and the material energy and distraction from the one shelter is having only one shelter. With humility, you're completely protected by Krishna because he's your only shelter. If you have other shelters, then you take shelter of those other shelters and try to find protection there, and there's no protection. It's a forest with vicious wild animals. So that's how to. Krishna is my only shelter. And to get to that place, you request Krishna. And mean it, and keep requesting. Don't move from that position of requesting Krishna's shelter. In the form of his service. As chanting itself is a service. Not that the other things are service and chanting is not a service. The chanting itself is a service. Take shelter of Krishna exclusively. Now the philosophical teachings we have support it. But it alone doesn't generate it. It's the actively taking shelter exclusively of Krishna. Anyone else? You ladies, you're disappointing me. You're not asking any questions. Any questions from the ladies' side, please? Yes, Mataji. Yes, fruitive mentality is very stubborn, even in devotional service.
Then how do we cultivate the understanding that Krishna is enjoyed when doing our devotional service?
How do we cultivate that understanding? Well, we're doing it right now. We've been hammering on this point with a sledgehammer and... by hearing in the proper mood, Bhagavatam teaches like this. When we hear in the proper mood, then that understanding, realization enters into the heart. And when the real realization enters into the heart, the darkness of illusion is dispelled. That's our primary method, is our hearing process. But then the hearing process has to go one more step, and that is you apply it. So even if your realization is 2%, 3%, 5%, apply it. And that will increase your realization. Prabhupada teaches this. By acting in knowledge, you get realization. It works. And then by that realization, it nurtures faith. So now with your faith having been nurtured, you go back to the process of hearing with more faith and more realization, so you can hear more. Even if it's the same message. So that way we're cultivating by hearing properly and applying two things, just to keep it real simple. The fruitive tendency becomes slackened on the strength of the devotional tendency dispelling it. Even still, as you said, fruitive tendency is very stubborn. So recognize that I've got this stubborn thing inside myself. It's not like them over there. They're the problem. I'm the problem. This fruitive tendency thing. I really have to be conscientious. Hearing and serving. And continuing in that way, being carefully guided. So that's a form of, that careful guidance is a form of protection against our own tendencies that are self-harmful. And as mentioned, humility is a form of protection also. Anything over here? Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.